special meeting on this January 14th at 1:32. We're not too bad, 2 minutes late, but we will try to be on time as we go along. And we will open up a work session first to introduce our members of the committee and our new administration staff, whom we feel very fortunate to have, and then a brief introduction of our members of the committee. So first, let's start to my right. Not that I'm trying to discriminate against you, Patty.
It's okay.
Matt, would you like to start things off? Just tell a little bit about yourself and the fact that you're so pleased to be on this committee.
Thank you very much, Chairman. I'm Max Sumner. I'm representative from House District 18, Silverton, Mount Angel, Malala. First term. I'm a brand new freshman at age 65. I am very happy to be here.
Thank you.
Right, Bob Ackerman, state representative from North Eugene. This is my sort of my third term and started my second session on the Land Use Committee.
My name is Greenlick, House District 33, Northwest Portland, all the way to North Plains. I served on land use with Chair Rudd in the last session in the interim, and I like that very much. And I can be reassured that your two vice chairs not only outrank you in seniority, but outrank you in age.
Another one of the aged ones. I'm Gordon Anderson. I represent Cave Junction, Grants Pass, and most of Josephine County. And this is my second term, and very excited to get back to work, and especially to be here for all of the deliberations on Measure 37 and land use policy.
Gordon's a lot older than I am, Mr. Chair.
Ooh, I'll admit it.
By 2 months.
Some guys will.
Well, good afternoon. Representative Patty Smith. I represent District 52, which is the beautiful Columbia River Gorge, Multnomah County, Clackamas, and Hood River County. And I won't mention my age. A little unfair, guys. But Mr. Chair, I'm very glad to participate in this committee, and I look forward to our continued discussions.
Thank you, Patty. We have, members of the committee, we have administrative staff, and to my right, it's Mr. Sam Lipke. And Sam, I'm going to let you tell us a little bit about yourself and the staff that we'll be working with in the next few months.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. I have been active in Oregon Land Use Planning since 1990, first with the city of Salem, then with Marion County, and for the last 10 years I've been working for the city of Silverton, doing basically all their aspects of planning for small communities. And my involvement's been with counties, larger cities, and with small cities, mostly a lot of current zoning, but as well as some comprehensive planning. So I hope that my background in there can help you during some of the forthcoming discussions that you have. I know that myself and my assistant, who's sitting to my far right, or Lindsay Lucky, will be more than happy to be able to assist you in getting materials that you feel that you need during upcoming discussions.
How can we go wrong? We have an assistant named Lucky. And we have been joined by Representative Mary Norman. Mary, we're just doing a brief introduction and welcoming you to this committee.
Thank you, and my apologies, Mr. Chair. Mary Norman, I represent District 36, which includes downtown Portland, Portland Riverfront, and the neighborhoods in the West Hills of Portland.
The chair is looking now to the committee rules and would seek a motion to adopt the committee rules.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the committee rules.
Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there anyone who... let's just go ahead and do our first roll on the committee rules.
Aye.
And the committee rules are adopted, and we will close the work session and begin our informational meeting portion. And we are quite sure that before we are done, this gentleman will be a familiar face, if not already, to many of us who had the pleasure of his company in the state legislature. It is good to see you, Mr. Lane Shetterly, the Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here, and happily I had at least a couple of chances during the interim to testify in front of legislative committees and get used to being on this side, but still feel it's just a little bit different. But still a pleasure to greet you today on your the fifth day of your session, your first committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I will address you going solo today, but I have my net behind me in the persons of Bob Lindy and Ron Eber, who you will also be seeing regularly during the course of this session. I thought what I would do this afternoon would be to just address some comments about the last year, primarily, since that has been the extent of my personal involvement at the department, but also give you some sense of what the department has done during the extent of going of this last interim, and what we see as being the direction for the program and for the department. I will not, do not intend in my remarks to get into Bellamy's at 37 today. I understand there's a joint meeting on Monday at which that will be addressed. By the same token, if you have questions about it, I'm happy to answer them. I just haven't intended to bring that into the scope of these remarks as well.
Thank you, Lynn. I was remiss in letting the committee know that 3 o'clock Monday we have a joint meeting with the Senate, and Senator Wingle has put together a who's who of land use in Oregon for testimony. So we will kind of set aside the major discussion on 37, and just we've asked Mr. Shetterly here for a day. It's basically an overview of how the agency's functioning and so forth. So, please proceed.
Okay, I will, and feel free to interrupt with questions anytime along the way. We distributed to you just for materials to review today a copy of a biennial report, which is the bound document that you have. It's to the 73rd Legislative Assembly. And then 3 informational bulletins, one on streamlining the land use planning program, another entitled Planning for Economic Development, and a third state agency efforts to implement Measure 37. Again, those were primarily for your information. My comments will touch on those, but I won't be testifying directly from them. When the governor asked me to undertake the directorship of the department, he gave me 3 specific charges that he was expecting me to fulfill and to follow personally, and also in my leadership of the department, and also working with the Land Conservation and Development Commission. And those charges were pretty explicit. Number one was to make the land use planning program and the department in particular better integrated with his statewide agenda of economic development. That is helping our local partners, in particular the city and county levels, to use the land use planning program to facilitate sustainable economic development and make the program work to that end in conjunction with his broader agenda statewide for economic development. The second charge was to work with the department in improving our relations with our local government partners and how we work with cities and counties and through them with citizens in the state, and in conjunction with that also following some of the efforts that had been undertaken even before I got there at streamlining the land use planning program and really trying to make it more usable and easier to access on the part of our local government partners as well as citizens. And then the third directive was to begin work during the interim on a bill that we have introduced as an agency bill that follows up from a bill that they just about made it out of Ways and Means at the end of last session, looking at a 30-year review of land use planning in the state for the purpose really of assessing where we are and where we want to be going in the future. Not so much a study effort to look at where we've been, but using that as an exercise to determine where we want to take this program that we've had for all of these 30 years.
Wayne,
yes.
The passage of Measure 37 interfere with that particular goal of the 30-year review of land use?
Mr. Chair, it's a good question. I will say, in all candor, it complicates it. Because certainly when we envisioned it at the beginning, it didn't have a Measure 37 component in it. By the same token, I don't think, and we'll have plenty of opportunities to talk with you and members of the committee about this, I don't think in any way that Measure 37 renders that unnecessary. Land use planning is still going to be part of our future, and in fact, doing it right is going to be essential for making sure that we sustain our economic recovery and good community development. So there is still a place for it, and in fact, you could make the argument that the passage of ballot Measure 37 actually makes that review, and especially the revisioning aspect of it, even more important, to find ways to make the program really mesh better with the principles and with the specifics of ballot Measure 37 than they do than it does perhaps today. So we'll have a chance, I'm glad to work with you as the session goes on, to really make that fit with the passage of ballot Measure 37. But I would, as we sit here today, I think that this is the exactly wrong time to turn our backs on an opportunity to review our land use planning program, again, not just for the purpose of a retrospective, but for the purpose of determining where we go from here, recognizing that Measure 37 is a component of it today. Now how do we make it work together? That'd be my answer on the fifth day of the session, but something I hope to develop with you as we go. In terms of the first charge, economic development, you've got one of the information sheets, planning for economic development, that I distributed. Also on page 9 of the biennial report, we talk about some of the activities that we have been involved in at the Department of Economic Development, really making that a central core. One thing you're not seeing in the report, but I think is just it sends a message, and it was something that we were trying to make clear in doing. Under Oregon.gov, if you go to the website, the state website, and you look for, up until about a week ago, if you looked for the Department of Land Conservation and Development, you would find it under the heading Natural Resources. That's historically where we have been. And clearly that represents an important and very proud history and component of the program. But within the last week, we have been working with the Department of Administrative Services and obtained their approval and the approval of the governor's office to be co-located on the website, not only under Natural Resources, but also under Economic Development. We think that's an important statement, recognizing that development is part of what we do as well. And so we have bridged both of those words now, in even in cyberspace, where you can find us under either Economic Development or under Natural Resources. And I'm very pleased with that. I think it's not earth-shattering, but I think it does send a significant message in terms of how we perceive ourselves at the department. In economic development, we were tasked, as I say we, the department, was tasked by the legislature through House Bill 2011 last session to do some very specific things that we have taken on. The department was a player and a lead player in the Industrial Lands Task Force and the certification process to identify certified industrial sites. In fact, one of our new Land Conservation Development Commissioners, Margaret Kirkpatrick from Portland, chaired the Governor's Industrial Lands Task Force. And then, as I said, we were partners with Oregon Economic and Community Development and several other state agencies in the industrial lands certification process, by which we have begun to identify certified industrial lands that are shovel-ready and available for development, not only in the valley, but happily in all parts of the state. And that is an ongoing process to continue to move sites into through certification so that they are on the market and available for ready development. We are participants in the governor's economic revitalization team. And with that, and I say we, that's a personal commitment on my part as director. We meet monthly with the governor's economic revitalization team staff, but then also we travel. I have been on the road with the economic revitalization team several times over the past year, meeting with local government officials specifically to address issues of local concern relative to economic development in ways that we, as directors of the agencies, can be together in one room to try and help solve problems that may cross agency lines. And it is a streamlining effort in practical terms that really has some benefit for the state to have the responsible agencies as a person of their directors and also their regional staffs that then are charged to carry out the solutions identified by the directors. And so we've seen good participation there from the department, not only from the director's office, but also right down through our line staff out into the regions. House Bill 2011 directed the department to create a committee on conversion of industrial lands. We've done that. A report has been made. You are getting copies of that. The issue there that was of concern to the last legislature was that we have we do not have all of the industrial lands available to us in the state that we should have for ready development, and as part of the problem, the fact that we are converting industrial lands to other uses and thereby losing them as being available for industrial development to other uses, commercial, residential, whatever the case may be. The conversion committee has evaluated that. I think you'll find in the report that it's not a clear answer that is a significant problem in the state. It's certainly one that we need to be aware of, and I think we are ahead of the curve in that. But we did take on that task of that conversion task force, and you will be receiving the report. We also have established for the first time in the department an economic development advisory committee made up of private sector and public sector representatives to advise the department on economic development strategies, basically how to do economic development within the land use planning program. With that, then we also have a team within the department of department staff whose jobs are expressly devoted to economic development and working with communities to help them implement Goal 9, which is our statewide land use planning goal that is directed to economic development, and making that a more principal part of our land use planning program, and helping cities and counties, helping local governments identify ways that they can implement Goal 9 to help themselves be more ready and available for economic development opportunities. We've also, through our grants program, awarded $200,000 in grants to communities for economic development planning activities. That is money that we pass through from general fund dollars to communities on a competitive grants basis for economic development planning. We have done that as part of our partnership with local governments. And we are in the process now at the Department and Commission of approaching a revision of our Goal 9 administrative rules to make Goal 9 easier for local communities to use and to understand, and how to see how it can benefit them in their economic planning and development. In terms of the second charge the governor gave us, working with our local government partners, I've been really pleased to see some of the development that we have made. In my first 7 or 8 months with the department, I spent probably on the order of 2 or 3 days a week traveling, and met with some of you in your districts out around. There was an advantage in that. We're just remembering today a lunch that I drove down for in Cave Junction and back one day to meet with some of his constituents, but also traveling to the far eastern part of the state, southern coast, metro area. In fact, it was one day in July when I was down in Brookings. I called home and spoke to my daughter one evening just to check in, and she's 11 years old. We had a conversation a few minutes into it. She said, "Are you gone?" I realized then that my absence had become ubiquitous. And thankfully, I've not had to keep up that travel, but I tell you, it has been of such great benefit to me personally, but also to the program, for the director to be out meeting in Hepner, in Baker City, in Hermiston, in Grove Beach, Brookings, Cave Junction, Medford, to create personal relationships and lines of communication that enable our local government partners to feel more a part of the system and the program. And I'll tell you, that has saved us, I do believe, some real potential problems. I'll just, if I may, I'll give you an example as to how we are really learning to work, I think, better with our local government partners. I was on it was a South Coast issue, a community down on the South Coast. We got word one day last summer that they had amended their comprehensive plan in violation of the process by which that is to be done. That is, there was no advance notice to us or, frankly, to the public. And the purpose of the comprehensive plan amendment was to facilitate the development of a residential development down very near the hazard line on the beach, above the beach. And this was brought to my attention, and because of the procedural issues, had to send them a nasty gram from the Department of Justice saying, you can't do this, and if you do, we're going to go after you. As it happened, I was already scheduled to be down in that community the next week. It was not a trip that I was looking forward to, having just sent that letter, but I went. And at the meeting that we had in that community, I met with the planner, the mayor, several of the council members, the developer and his representatives, and our regional staff. And at that meeting, along with Representative Krueger, we went down to the beach with maps in hand to look at where they intended to do the development, where the hazard line was on the maps, discuss issues that we had with the city about that. And in the course of about a 40-minute conversation on the beach, had resolved about 99% of the issues that looked like were going to be intractable at one point. We came back, we helped the city rescind the resolution that they had advisedly adopted. We assisted them actually then in rewriting the resolution to make sure that it accomplished what they wanted to get done in a way that would be procedurally sound. They adopted it and were able to go forward within the compliance of the rules, within compliance of the goals and statutes, and avoided an appeal that could have tied this thing up for a long time. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's one story, but we've had several like that in this past year of the department that I think signals a new attitude towards working with the communities to help them through the process, to use our expertise to help them accomplish what the land use planning program permits them to do and to be successful. I'm pleased to say that we've had several stories like that that demonstrate success. We also have an active grants program, not only for economic development, but for technical assistance, so that especially in small communities that don't have substantial planning staff, we are able to provide them with the dollars to hire consultants and experts to assist them in their planning. And along with that, we use our regional staff and our specialists here in Salem to actually work with them in City Hall and at the County Planning Department toward their planning efforts. And then the last thing before I stop my remarks would be to address just a few things that we are doing to streamline the land use planning program to make it to work better and to make it easier for communities to access and to accomplish their objectives. A couple of things I touched on there on this handout, and we also mentioned them in the report that I distributed. A couple of years ago, the Court of Appeals decided a case called the Beaver State case that ended a conditional use permit process for the siting of small aggregate mines. And it had immediate impacts on our aggregate industry and, frankly, even extending up to ODOT. It was very concerned about their ability to access aggregate for the projects that they're going to be putting online in the near future with the OTIA funding. We got to work earlier this year, and in July was successful in amending the administrative rule that reestablished a conditional use process, addressed the problems identified by the Court of Appeals in the Beaver State case, and so we have reestablished a conditional use permit, conditional use process for small aggregate mines in the valley as well as around the state. We are working with a work group of private sector and local government folks to amend the process by which we amend urban growth boundaries. That has become an incredibly complex process that has made it difficult for cities to navigate to achieve an urban growth boundary expansion or amendment. And we have the we are amending the goal 14 that deals with urban growth boundary amendments. Urban growth boundaries, and we will have that in front of the commission next month. That is first step, a down payment in that process of streamlining. Once we've established the changes in the goal, we'll be continuing the changes in the rule, again, to make it more rational and easier for cities to navigate the process. Among other things that we'll be looking at, we'll be establishing safe harbors in order for cities to amend an urban growth boundary. They need to demonstrate, for instance, certain numbers in terms of population growth and density of housing and employment. Every one of those determinations is something that can be appealed. Every determination the city makes along the way. And we're working with local governments to create some safe harbors for cities to be able to use and say, well, if we adopt these numbers, if we're going to use these numbers, then those numbers will be deemed acceptable and will not be subject to appeal. Not that cities would be required to use them. If they wanted to be more aggressive, they could do. If they wanted to be more conservative, they could do. If they can show the data, but through these safe harbors, provide a process that for cities that choose can use something that will be much more streamlined and less subject to appeal. We are, as directed by the legislature, we are working with a work group to streamline and improve the periodic review process, and we'll be making a report to the governor. I believe that's where that report goes. That should be coming out within the next couple of weeks. We're not anticipating legislative action, at least from the department on that, but we will present it to the governor and the legislature for consideration and possible action. Statewide Planning Bill 11, that addresses sewer services to properties outside of urban growth boundaries and unincorporated communities. We're amending that rule to remove the prohibition that currently exists that makes it sets up a situation where you can have a sewer line from an existing sewer district in a rural portion of the state where you have a house located along that line but unable to connect to that line because of restrictions in Bill 11. We're amending the rule to allow connections within 300 feet of that line so that you don't have those places sitting out on septic lines next to a fully functioning sewer line that under today's rule is not able to connect. We'll be addressing that goal amendment in February as well. I think there have been some other housekeeping things that are addressed in the sheet, and I really would commend the biennial report to you for your careful review. I'm very proud of it. We've tried to keep it readable, not too long, and not too technical, but I believe it does communicate the themes that I have tried to speak on today, our commitment to economic development, our commitment to working better with local governments and our constituents statewide, and streamlining the land use planning program, and then working with you in this 30-year review and revisioning of the land use planning program, all in conjunction with, of course, Ballot Measure 37 and whatever else may be forthcoming from this committee and the House and Senate this session. So look forward to working with you. I think it's going to be a good session. I'm pleased to have the chance to work with my former colleagues and Representative Sumner, I'm pleased to welcome as well to this institution, and be happy to answer questions now or anytime you want me back.
Questions from the committee. Representative Weiner.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, I want to commend you and your change of culture in DLCD. That is very clear from the time you call up, and if there's nobody answering the phone, gets your cheerful voice apologizing for there not being somebody there. That struck me as being a very important thing. I do have a couple of questions. First, on page 18, you talk about TGM. Well, it's sort of a confusing number on the top that says you either give out $5 million or some very large number. Maybe you can have somebody someday explain what that number is supposed to be up there. But I am...
I think that's a gotcha.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you who got the $500, but I couldn't figure out whether it was $500 or $500 million. But my question on this is could you talk a little bit about how TMG works and the extent to which we really can be seriously asking some questions about how transportation and land use relate in a multimodal way? I mean, I was thinking, for example, the extent to which the Washington County commuter train could change land use patterns and land use issues, and particularly if we can succeed in extending it between Beaverton and Salem, which is been a goal that I've always had, how that might change the relationship of land in Kaiser to land in Oregon, and how this TGM process fits into that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwick. I will answer to the extent that we have time today and also the extent of my ability. We've got staff, of course, that is devoted to TGM back of program, and I would encourage you to invite us back sometime to bring them along to talk in detail about the Transportation and Growth Management Program. In essence, what the Transportation and Growth Management Program recognizes is that there is as your question suggests, a definite connection between transportation and planning. What you place on the ground is going to have an impact on your transportation facilities, and what kind of transportation facilities you provide is going to affect what kind of development you would be able to pursue. And so TGM is recognizing that it's both a land use and transportation component, is a joint program of ODOT and the Department of Land Conservation and Development that does several things. There is an outreach program through TGM that assists, again, where we put our specialists out in working with City Hall and local governments in helping them develop their transportation codes so that if they're in sync with their planning and they're not getting themselves out of kilter. We have a quick response program that actually provides dollars to local governments to bring in consultants to develop transportation improvements and facilities in local communities. There are a couple of them cited on page 19. And I should also mention, in terms of what we are doing in streamlining the program, those of you who followed during the interim, there was a case decided by the Court of Appeals out of Eugene Peace Health. It's also known as the Jacob decision. Representative Ackerman is familiar with it, I am sure. But it raised an issue as to one of the administrative rules under our one of our transportation planning rules that comes within this ambit, and that was the extent to which a community may be required to provide transportation facilities in order to develop, and do we have, raised the question, do we have what's called concurrency in Oregon, where you can't develop unless you provide concurrent transportation improvements. That raised serious concerns from the development community, the extent that a concurrency requirement means that until there are dollars on the ground reflected in street improvements and other highway and transportation improvements, that there is no development that can occur. We have a joint committee of the Land Conservation Development Commission and Oregon Transportation Commission working even as we speak to amend address amendments to the transportation planning rule to clarify some flexibility and clarify that there is flexibility in coordinating land use planning and transportation in order to avoid any unwanted impacts on development that we would otherwise want to encourage. But that's it. The philosophy of it is simply a recognition that transportation and growth need to be coordinated. You've talked about what happens in Hillsborough or Wilsonville, and transportation can affect what happens in Kaiser. Certainly we're seeing it in Central Oregon, where you have Bend, you have up the road, you have Redmond, and now you've got Prineville kind of coming on in development there, and the impacts that that has on highway 97 and the other corridors connecting those cities. It's important to stay ahead of. We have a lot of money invested in our transportation infrastructure in the state, and by through a TGM program, we hope to coordinate planning and transportation to make sure that we're not using, that one is not having any unintended and untoward consequences on the other.
Follow up very briefly, sir. A very brief follow-up. Thank you. That's reoccurring. I hope we will have a chance to hear you folks. I just wanted to comment that I hope the notion of tying other forms of transportation beyond roads and cars can get into this whole planning process, and that they can be interactive in a way that would be very useful.
Well, thank you for that follow-up, Mr. Chair. Representative Greenlick, one of the policy statements in the rule is to foster choices in transportation. That is one of the policies of it, where those are feasible, and certainly that would include rail, commuter rail, light rail, as well as every other alternative form of transportation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Seeing none? Boy,
we will have plenty of time to converse, I'm sure, as the session goes, so I'll be glad to come back. I will see you on Monday, Mr. Chair. We'll talk a little bit about the history of the program. I've got Bob Rindy and Ron Eber prepared to cover that, and then I'll talk a little bit about Measure 37 and what we're doing in response to that.
Certainly, I think you and your staff, though, are to be commended since you took the directorship. We've seen some very positive things happen under your direction, and I think this committee would like to recognize that.
I appreciate that very much. It's
Mr. Chairman, Mr. So I'd like to say anecdotally, first time I met Mr. Chatterley, it was in a room full of, they could be described, rabid land use advocates. And Mr. Chatterley did not send a representative or an agent. Early Saturday morning, Mr. Chatterley came himself. And everyone in the room was very impressed with the idea that a department head would actually come representing himself and speak to that group. They were all favorably impressed. I was even more so. And even as a candidate, we were having lunch together at LCD on his time while he was trying to bring me and others up to speed on what LCD is doing in the state now. I commend that sort of leadership, and everyone I know does. And I look forward to working with you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate those comments. That was about the end of my first, no, I've been in the job about 2 weeks, I think, and that was the Oregon International Land Use Forum up at the Holiday Inn in Wilsonville. But I'm glad I went. You know, we serve all Oregonians, and we don't all agree, but nevertheless, we serve them, and it's important to connect and communicate.
Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to add one note to what Director Shettle said in his trip to Cave Junction. He kind of was like the U.S. mail through hail and storm and everything. On the way down, he had a flat tire, and the poor guy had to get Les Schwab or somebody to fix the tire while we went from Grants Pass to Cave Junction and back to pick up his car and come home. 8 hours round trip?
About.
Good job. And really, really put people at ease with the problem that we had in the Cave Junction area.
We're going to have to cut this off. Too many compliments.
Well, it's also fair to put in the record that he doesn't buy lunch at his lunch.
That's true.
You have to bring your own.
Mr. Chair, that is an aspect of budget responsibility. You buy your own.
And do we see a few more gray hairs than you had as a legislative member?
I think so.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good
working with you.
We will next move on and ask to come forward Ms. Ann Hennis, Director of the Department of State Lands. Ann, welcome, and it's nice to see you again.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'd also like to introduce the staff that's joined me here today. John Lilly, who is the Assistant Director of Policy and Planning. He's hopefully going to be able to take care of the equipment there. Steve Purchase is in charge of Field Operations, Assistant Director, and Jeanette Holman is Assistant Director in charge of Finance and Administration. She also serves as our legislative coordinator. Oh, good. Looks like we've got it working. We have kind of a Plan A and Plan B. The Plan A is the high-tech version, and the Plan B is the low-tech version with our presentation. I'll give you an overview of the Department of State Lands. There's John getting this set up. that. There we go. The overall mission of the Department of State Lands is to ensure a legacy for Oregonians and their public schools through sound stewardship of lands, wetlands, waterways, unclaimed property, estates, and the common school fund. We act as the administrative arm of the State Land Board, which is the governor, the treasurer, and the secretary of state. We manage common school fund assets. These are lands and waterways that were granted to statehood in 1859, as well as unclaimed property in estates where there's no air or rails. We protect and conserve the state waterways and wetlands through the removal field program, and we also oversee the South Sioux National Estuary and Reserve and the Natural Heritage Program. Under our current agency organization, in addition to the director's office, we have the divisions of field operations, policy and planning, and finance and administration. And then I mentioned South Sioux and the Natural Heritage Advisory Council. However, we are planning an agency reorganization that will take place later this year. And in that reorganization, we'll be going toward having a land management division that will be headed by Steve Purchase, wetlands and waterway conservation, which will be removal field fight with John Lilly, and finance and administration with Jeanette. Turning to the land board, according to the Oregon's Constitution, the land board manages lands with the object of obtaining the greatest benefit for the people of the state, consistent with the conservation of this resource under sound techniques of land management. Our overall mission for the Department of State Lands really focuses on the Common School Fund. And the Common School Fund is a permanent trust fund that benefits current and future generations of our school kids from grades K through 12. And all our agency programs contribute to the Common School Fund. This next slide shows you how the Common School Fund works. We have constitutional revenue that flows in, and those are the two, we have two sections out of every township, beginning with the state of Ohio, at a time when our country was land rich and cash poor. We were looking for ways to support the schools. And so the state was given a land grant of these two sections, and that comprises the constitutional revenue, so it's the management activities that we earn from that. And then statutory revenue are those revenue sources that have been assigned by the legislature, and that also includes unclaimed property. That all flows into this permanent trust fund, and that trust fund then generates earnings. We invest that in the stock market, and then those earnings then flow to the schools. John, next slide. In terms of the Common School Fund, the State Treasurer and the Oregon Investment Council invest that fund. The values have ranged between $600 and $900 million. I'm really pleased that if the stock market stays up, the value is now around $900 million for the Common School Fund. And that's really good news for our schools. In terms of distribution, it's distributed according to a policy that the land board has. It's a sliding scale distribution. It depends on the year-over-year change of the fund. And those annual distributions then have ranged between $9 and $31 million, depending on the change in the fund. The good news for this biennium is that because the Common School Fund is up considerably, the distributions to schools are going to be about $54 million. So that's considerably higher than what they've been in the last couple of years. For land management, we manage 133,000 acres of forest land, 638,000 acres of rangeland. We also have agricultural land leases. We've got 150 rangeland leases and 11 agricultural leases. Those rangeland and agricultural leases generate $850,000 for the Common School Fund over the biennium. We also manage 4 million acres of mineral rights. all of the state-owned mineral rights, including exploration and production leases, go are managed by DSL. We also manage 3 miles out of the territorial seas, as well as coastal and ocean resources, special uses where we might have, for example, cell phone towers or radio towers on common school fund land, as well as easements, such as for waterway easements. This map here kind of illustrates all the different types of land management activities we're involved with in DSL, ranging from forest management in the Elliott State Forest. We've been involved with the New Carissa because that's been on state-owned lands. Fiber optic cables coming in, we've received revenue from those. Gravel leases, rangeland management, waterway leases, such as, for example, if you go up into the Portland area and you see houseboats there, we receive revenue from the leases of where those houseboats are and where and docks are. John, next slide. This is because of the submerged and submersible lands that we manage. We have about 410 waterway leases generating $2.6 million over the biennium for schools, and that's about 1,350 dock registrations that also contribute. Our forest lands, the largest forest land we have is the Elliott State Forest. That's basically the crown jewel of the common school fund lands. About 85,000 acres out of the 133,000 acres we have. The Oregon Department of Forestry is actually under contract to the Department of State Lands to manage that. They that forest generates $22 million over the biennium. Let me talk now about some of the initiatives that we're involved with, and then I'll get into some other areas of responsibility for the agency. We're trying to boost the overall value of the Common School Fund with the idea that we want to really boost the money that goes to schools and distributions. So we've been taking some very aggressive measures in order to do that. One, we've looked at what tracts of land should we sell that are isolated, difficult to manage. And so at the land board meeting coming up in February, we've got 13 tracts of land that we're going to be selling. We're pursuing our federal in-lieu land transfer. Earlier I mentioned that the state received two sections out of every township at the time of statehood. Well, it's at the time of statehood and a little bit after, some of those sections were already occupied, like homesteads or Indian reservations. And thus the state actually has an IOU coming to it for the Common School Fund, about 3,200 acres. We recently sent in a letter to the BLM asking for that IOU to be cashed in. And what we're looking at is getting lands that would have high value, would be in the path of progress, and that would greatly benefit the Common School Fund. And we hope that that's going to be completed within the next year and a half. We're revising our asset management plan. This is our strategic plan for managing our real estate assets for the Common School Fund, looking at where can we get the highest return and what can we do to generate more income for our schools. We are seeking budget items so that we can pursue that more active land management. I just returned from a meeting with other states in the West who also have similar school land, and they're very active in the kind of land management they're doing, ranging from developing lands for commercial activities to pursuing things like wind generation and other ideas to boost their returns for the Common School Fund. And then I would also mention that we're reorganizing the agency, and then there's a proposal to transfer unclaimed property to Treasury as a way to focus on some of the major issues for unclaimed property. In terms of the removal fill program, this is another area that the agency is responsible for. We process permits for removal and fill of materials in wetlands and waterways. We do about 1,000 applications a year. And the reason for having a removal fill program is to protect, conserve, and make the best use of our water resources, to protect public navigation, fishery, and recreational uses, ensuring that activities of one landowner don't adversely affect another landowner. For example, if one landowner does something along a riverbank, that can push the water and adversely affect another landowner downstream. So we try to be aware of what impacts that might have on one property or another. Also, wetlands and waterways are very important, especially when we think about flood control, water quality, and habitat.
And do you see a direct tie between that, the landowners adjacent to one another, and Measure 37? Do you see any conflict down the road with that?
You mean in terms of the removal field program? As you know, there's a whole lot of uncertainty in the removal field program, in the ballot measure 37, and what we're trying to determine right now along with Department of Justice is exactly how ballot measure 37 applies to the removal field program. So it's a big question mark for us right now.
Thank you.
The removal field program, we've been very involved with the economic revitalization team and the governor's efforts to have industrial sites certified. We developed an expedited process to identify and mitigate loss of wetlands on industrial sites, and we adopted new rules to that effect. And we've given top priority to review wetland delineation reports associated with industrial certification sites. One of the ways in which this directly translated into an economic development effort was Amy's Kitchen in Southern Oregon. We worked real closely to ensure that where they were going to be located would not be in a wetland, and we were able to do and move forward with the development that they wanted, and as a result, benefited greatly from that. We completed site planning and wetland mitigation planning on five sites: Rainier, Lebanon, Coos Bay, Sutherland, North Bend. So those sites are going to be able to move forward for industrial development. As well as we've conducted site evaluations for Eastern Oregon sites. We've analyzed the potential for wetland impacts on about 70 sites proposed for certification. On the economic revitalization team, as part of that, I traveled around the state, and oftentimes, you know, Lane and I were together on that, along with Stephanie Halleck and the other members of the economic revitalization team. And that team I found to be extremely helpful in trying to cut through all the red tape and figure out what we can do to make economic development happen. South Sioux Reserve is another component of Department of State Lands. This was the first national estuary reserve that was identified in the country. It includes 4,800 acres of open water tidelands. It's located down near Coos Bay. It's managed for research, education, on estuary systems and restoration. It's also a real important tourist destination. There are 25,000 visitors that go to South Sioux each year, including around over 6,000 students that visit South Sioux and learn about oceans and estuaries. The research that's conducted down there have been focused on estuaries, oyster culture, tidal marsh classification, water quality monitoring. They're important for the coastal communities. We've had volunteers there that have volunteered over 13,000 hours. We've also worked at trying to further the economic efforts of the local community there through a co-location with the Charleston Merchants, as well as restoring estuary wetland. We work closely with the schools through a live webcast that I think is very entertaining, as well as a way to reach out to all of the schools. Looking at the major issues that I think you'll be concerned with, as well as how it affects our agency, I mentioned we're trying to increase the long-term returns to the Common School Fund. We're looking at how best to manage the real estate assets that we have. And I think that can be a real legacy for our schools, because the more they can get in those distributions, the more it's helpful. Having a daughter in seventh grade and a teacher, it really brings home the importance to me about what those distributions mean to the schools. Hazardous waste cleanup is another major issue we've been wrestling with. for example, on the Portland Harbor, where DSL manages submerged and submersible lanes. Portland Harbor cleanup is one we've been working very, very closely with Department of Environmental Quality to make sure this moves forward. Economic revitalization, I think, is essential to continue and to keep Oregon's economy moving forward. Having formerly been the state's economist, thinking that this continues to happen, I believe, is a very high priority for us. We are engaged in streamlining the removal fill program, and we're in the final stages of being able to get a statewide programmatic general permit with the Army Corps of Engineers. The Army Corps of Engineers regulates basically the removal fill program side on the federal side. What our aim is that under certain categories, if you come to the Department of State Lands and you get a permit, you won't have to go to the Army Corps of Engineers. You'll know that you have assurance under the Endangered Species Act, and we hope that it will be much easier for the applicant. Within the next couple months, we hope that that will be signed and that it will be implemented later this year. We've also worked real closely with the Technical Advisory Committee on that so that it meets the needs of users of the program. Ballot Measure 37 is a big question mark for us. We don't yet know what it fully means for the removal fill program, and so as we work closely with the legislature and Department of Justice, I think we'll all learn more together about that one. Navigability is an issue that's been around since statehood, and it's one that the legislature wrestled with last session, and I'm sure that that issue is going to be, again, one that you'll be concerned with as well. We came close to having a bill passed in the last session, but it didn't make it. And thus, the only recourse now is we receive requests for navigability as we work through a pretty arduous and long legislative process, but that means that we've had to deal with the John Doe River, which the Land Board held a hearing in Condon in December. The Rogue River is the one that's up next, and I think you're well aware of that. And then we've got rivers down the line. So we definitely would love to be able to work on trying to find an alternative and an overall solution for the state on that one. Elliott State Forest Management Plan is another issue. The Department of Forestry has been putting together a plan that will affect the overall management of the Elliott State Forest, including how we deal with endangered species such as the spotted owl and northern murrelet, at the same time generating revenue through harvest of timber. The next couple pages show the legislation that the agency and the Land Board have put forward. We have copies of that provide you with more information on it. Just kind of quickly, there are two bills dealing with the South Slough National Estuary Reserve. One of those would authorize the fees could be charged at the South Slough as a way to offset the impact of the Common School Fund. And another one is recognizing with the government-to-government relations that the state and tribal governments have established to add a tribal member to the South Slough Commission. Trust property, one bill deals with improving the notice when there's when someone dies without a will or an heir. And then on House Bill 2129 is just a streamlining bill so that you can allow notice by first-class mail. Another several bills are connected with the removal fill program. One of them would streamline through allowing us to assume Section 404 of the Federal Clean Water Act. I mentioned earlier we streamlined with the statewide programmatic general permit that we're hoping to complete in the next couple months. If we assume 404, then it would be the full breadth of the removal fill program. The House Bill 2130 would increase fees for the program. Right now, fees cover between less than 20% of the cost of the removal fill program. Revenues that otherwise would go into the common school fund then pay for the removal fill program, and this would increase fees in order to allow more money to go into the common school fund. And then also there would be a new fee. This was something that the technical advisory committee members called for as a way to expedite the wetland delineation reports. And then, let's see, and then we also have a bill, Senate Bill 170, to have a policy discussion. One of the things we've heard from the Agricultural Committee is they'd like to have the exemptions in the state program and the federal program be more closely aligned, so that it brings a lot more clarity to the program. We've put forward this bill so that essentially the exemptions that are in the removal fill program mirror federal law. So that ends my presentation. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions from the committee? And where does the what amount does the common school fund stand at today?
It's around $900 million. And it's grown considerably. It's grown from about less than $200 million in the late 80s. In the late 80s, there was a ballot measure that voters approved to allow the state to invest the program, invest the monies in stocks and bonds. And so it was able to ride that stock market increase in the 90s. It was just one of those, it was passed just in time. So now we're up to $900 million.
I think your agency has done a great job of managing that fund.
Thank you. And my hope is to have it, you know, I'm looking to try to double that size of that common school fund in the next 7 to 10 years.
Great, it can be wonderful. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's talk of merging the 700J permit on turbidity for the dredgers and gold miners so that DEQ would give up the right and DSL, I believe, would handle the permitting. What's the logic behind that? It seems that they're really the ones that are concerned about turbidity and you have other responsibilities.
I think this is an effort to try to streamline that part of the program. I'm also going to have John Lilly, if you can join me up here, talk about that. Because he's been the one that's working most closely on it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, thank you for asking that question. We had a dialogue somewhat similar a while back.
Would you identify yourself?
Certainly,
sir.
Thank you. I'm John Lilly, Assistant Director for the Department of State Lands. DEQ, as you correctly point out, is currently going through rulemaking to update its 700J permit, which primarily would affect placer miners or recreational placer miners. The Department of State Lands, through the removal fill program, also regulates these same folks and requires, as a condition of our permit, that the required 700J or Department of Environmental Quality approvals be in place for those operators to be permitted under the state, under the Department of State Lands permit. So it, in conversations with DEQ, it seemed that there was some logic in maybe doing having one portal, one place for these recreational placer miners to come to so that they could get both of their certifications in one location. And the Department of State Lands has had an ongoing relationship with the placer mining community. We've worked closely with them over the last 10, 12 years. Recently, we put up on our website a interactive permitting system so that miners could go online and have their permit self-issued to them. And that was, excuse me, as a result of some conversations with the placer mining community. So we think that we've got maybe the start of something that might streamline that interface between the miners and the agencies and be able to still protect the resource, but provide that permit at a, in an efficient, cost-effective way.
Do you have the enforcement capacity to be able to follow that out in terms of turbidity and measuring that, or today, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the details as to how all this would work are yet to be hammered out. What we do recognize is that we believe we need statutory authority to be able to enter into such agreement with the EQ. What we have spoken of at this point, very preliminarily with the DEQ folks, is that under any kind of agreement that we would put together, we would need to make sure that the necessary resources were in place at the agency level to be able to adequately monitor the work of miners in the field. And that might include some self-monitoring by the miners. It may also include some on-site monitoring by the Department of Environmental Quality and or DSL staff. But the details are yet to be worked out.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? And thank you very much.
I look forward to working with you, and if you have any questions about any of the issues or any constituent issues, please feel free to call me or any one of my staff.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Committee, our next meeting will be 3 o'clock on Monday, a joint meeting with the Senate in this room at 3 p.m. So hope you'll have a good weekend, and next week we'll roll our sleeves up and really begin to get to work. The House Committee on Land Use is adjourned.